my welcome to you, and in particular to those who are first-time visitors. We welcome you and especially encourage you to join us after the worship service for coffee and conversation. And information about the church is available from the new member desk in the fellowship hall there, and from any people gathered around here. So if you're new and have questions, just ask somebody. And if they don't know the answer, they'll help you find someone who does. We have visitor information cards that you may fill out in the back of your hymnal and put in the offering plate or give to an usher. And we'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about all the programs and activities going on here at church. And we're glad you're here. And we hope to see you again in future Sundays. If you have children with you, they're invited to attend our religious education program when the young people leave for classes later in the service. And we do have a professionally staffed nursery for infants and young children. And in addition, adults are encouraged to attend the adult religious education programming each week at 11:50 following this service. We welcome everyone into this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. And I have a few announcements. Were there any announcements in the basket? Next Friday, on April the 3rd, we're going to be serving lunch to those attending the community Lenten service here at church. And we will need volunteers to bring desserts. We need pies or cakes or cookies or fresh fruit. And there's a sign-up sheet on the desk in the worker room, so please sign up if you can bring something for that lunch. The service itself starts at noon and the lunch will start at 12:30. Next Sunday at 11:50, there will be a new member orientation led by Pastor Sunshine Wolf for those who have recently joined the church or who are considering joining the church. So please think about attending that next Sunday. If you recently requested a name tag, look in the name tag box in the desk, because there are several there that have not been picked up. And if you need a name tag, there's a blue card there that you can fill out and put in a box, and you will get a name tag. And we have marked the first three pews nearest the piano as fragrance-free zone. If you are wearing cologne, perfume, aftershave, or use soap, shampoos, lotions, deodorants with fragrances, please refrain from sitting in those three pews. Thank you. We begin our service this morning with a prelude. As Jerry Johnson lights our chalice, as he maybe lights our chalice. Please please join me in reciting the words on the wall there? Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Please rise, as your spirits and body allow, to sing hymn number 318, We Would Be One.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Somebody even used my name. So today I'm going to share with you the poem, The Generals by Shel Silverstein. Said General Clay to General Gore, "Oh, must we fight this silly war? To kill and die is such a bore." "I quite agree," said General Gore. Said General Gore to General Clay, "We could go to the beach today and have some ice cream on the way." "A grand idea," said General Clay. Said General Clay to General Gore, "We'll build sandcastles on the shore." Said General Gore, "We'll splash and play." "Oh, let's leave right now, said General Clay. Said General Gore to General Clay, "What if the sea is closed today? And what if the sand's been blown away?" "Oh, dreadful thought," said General Clay. Said General Gore to General Clay, "I've always feared the ocean's spray. And we may drown, it's true, we may. It chills my blood, said General Clay. Said General Clay to General Gore, "My bathing suit is slightly tore. We'd better to go on with our war." "I quite agree," said General Gore. Then General Clay charged General Gore, and his bullets flew and cannons roared. And now, alas, there is no more of General Clay or General Gore. Thank you.
Thank you.
and share briefly any gratitude or celebrations you bring with you to church this morning. There will be time to share concerns and sorrows in a few moments. I then invite you to move to the microphone and share briefly any sorrows or concerns you bring with you to church this morning.
Hello, everyone. I would just ask for continued prayers for my dad, John. He's fighting pancreatic cancer right now, and he has undergone one round of chemo, and he is now starting his next session of daily radiation and weekly chemo. So if you could keep him in your thoughts and prayers, I'd appreciate it.
Well, after a very long decline, Diane Thompson's grandfather passed away yesterday afternoon. And some of you people have seen him in the sanctuary here playing his fiddle and reciting poetry, but she was in town but left already. So I don't know what the arrangements are or if there'll be arrangements or what's going to happen, but just so that the community knows.
May the gratitude and celebration among us this day become a blessing to all. And may the concerns and sorrows of each be carried in all our hearts, a burden shared become a load lightened. Let us now enter a time of silent reflection, meditation, or prayer. May the consciousness of the universe that connects all souls comfort and strengthen each one and bring peace and wisdom into every life. Please join in singing Spirit of Life. Is a former president of the Unitarian Universalist Association and currently the head of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. This is the mission of our faith, to teach the fragile art of hospitality, to revere both the critical mind and the generous heart, to prove that diversity need not mean divisiveness, and to witness to all that we must hold the whole world in our hands. Today's fresh spring flowers, fresh, colorful, and bold in their abundance, come from last year's seed, carefully saved to bloom again. Let your offering today be that seed from where tomorrow's beauty comes. This morning's offering will be gratefully received. May it be joyfully given. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves, and these are our offerings.
For our responsive reading, we'll use 662, Strange and Foolish Waltz. The years of all of us are short, our lives precarious.
Our days and nights go hurrying on, and there is scarcely time to do the little that we might.
Yet we find time for bitterness, for petty treason, and evasion.
What can we do to stretch our hearts enough to lose their littleness?
Here we are, all of us, all on this planet, bound together in a common destiny.
Living our lives between the briefness of the daylight and the night.
Kindred in this, each lighted by the same precarious, flickering flame of life. How does it happen that we are not kindred in all things else? Our sermon today is A World with No More War. A popular idea is the idea of a world with no more war. Why does that ideal seem so far off or so unlikely that it's not even worth thinking about? Well, I think that an important part of the answer to that question of why we don't make more progress is that our media and everyday conversation focuses on other things, like number one, the disastrous effects of wars, while showing little interest in the causes of wars, or the ideas about what needs to be done to prevent them. Number two, the heroism and sacrifices of soldiers fighting present wars is focused on, rather than whether such suffering might be eliminated. A third focus is activities of military and political leaders as they prepare for battle against other countries, rather than whether wars are necessary. Fourth, the new weapons that are being designed to fight wars are focused on, rather than whether war could be eliminated. And number five, the need for national governments to spy on each other rather than on whether the war system must continue. It's a matter of where the focus is. The focus on these matters just stimulates people to get ready to fight the next war, including supporting much military spending for new weaponry and military training. That's where the focus is, not on what might be done to end the problem. Almost nothing is said about the nature of the present international system of nation states with their unlimited national sovereignty and the fact that it is a system which produces wars. It is a system that keeps us in bondage to war. Too often, even those who are interested in peace focus on individual behavior, what we should do with regard to other individuals, rather than on our political institutions and our social customs. After all, war is between group and group, not between individual and individual. Now, I see this as a problem even within our denomination. We had a big commission on how to get peace, and it almost degraded to talking about how we get along with one another as individuals, not how we need to change our political institutions. Another thing people say, there's no use talking about getting rid of war because you can never get rid of all conflict. A crucial distinction that needs to be remembered in order to successfully confront this problem of war is to note that war is not the same as conflict. Maybe in human society, there will always be conflicts. But that does not mean that there will always be wars. To end wars, we need institutions which keep these conflicts from becoming violent. And we have done it in most of our institutions. Governments have been created to control conflicts within society and to keep them from becoming violent. Democratic governments, especially, have been relatively successful in doing this. Of course, there still may be civil wars to determine which organized group gains control of the government, like we have in some newer democracies. But such civil wars are very unlikely in long-established democracies. Are we going to have war within the United States? Are we going to have war in Western Europe? No, everyone expects that the governments are going to keep peace. More important for our understanding of warfare is the fact that after governments were established, Then wars began between these governments. Governments aimed to produce the and expand the territory which they happened to control. As a result, some governments came into conflict with other governments, and there was no government over them to keep the conflicts from becoming violent. That's exactly why we have wars. Just as governments were developed to control conflicts between individuals and groups within the society, we finally learned how to control the conflicts between governments. We created cooperative associations of governments called confederations and then federations. That development occurred in Switzerland with smaller governed societies and in our own country with larger governed societies called states. At first, there was no distinction between a confederation and a federation. That was the case at the time when the United States was created. The words were used interchangeably. But then a similar development occurred both in Switzerland among the cantons and in the United States among the states. In both places, an association which began as a confederation became a federation. So that means we need to think carefully, what's the difference? We can distinguish between a confederation and a federation, even though in fact the former very often gradually evolves into the latter. Confederations become federations. We can say, in a general way, a confederation or league is a looser association of governments, while a federation or union is a stronger or tighter association. The key term is sovereignty, which means possessing ultimate authority. That is, no one else has any authority over you. It originally applied to kings, called sovereigns. The sovereigns who had ultimate authority in the country where they ruled. What they said was law. Afterward, as more countries became democracies, that term sovereign began to be applied to the national governments. And as a result, we got the notion of unlimited national sovereignty. Each national government had the sole right to determine what is legally permissible within its national borders. The history of our own country exemplifies the distinction between a confederation in which the component state governments retained all of their sovereignty, as in the Articles of Confederation, note the word confederation, the Articles of Confederation from 1775 to 1789. And that they were the governing way when we were fighting the Revolutionary War. But after the war was over, the states started fighting with each other. And a federation in which some areas of control or sovereignty get transferred from the component states to the new federal government. The Constitution indicates certain powers will go to the federal government. Others will be retained by the state government. That particular transformation occurred when the U.S. Constitution was ratified by all the state governments, except Rhode Island, didn't do it till afterward, in 1787 to 1788. 2 years went from the Confederation, the Articles of Confederation, to adoption of the U.S. Constitution, and George Washington becomes the first president in 1789. Elected in 1788, becomes president in 1789. A very important distinction between a confederation and a federation is whether the component governments that make up the association have a right to secede from their commitment to join the association or federation. In a confederation, states have a right to secede, but not in a federation. The U.S. Civil War was really a war to determine whether the United States of America was a confederation where states could secede, or a federation or a union where states could not secede. That was what the war was all about. The slogan for the creation of the United States was E Pluribus Unum, which is Latin for out of many, one. That's the idea of a federation. Lincoln made it clear during the Civil War that the purpose of the war was, quote, to preserve the Union, unquote. Not getting rid of slavery. That wasn't, it was a side issue. The big issue was, is the Union going to be preserved? Is a federation going to be preserved? Now, many of our court cases in this country are to determine the limits of state sovereignty. Going back to the Constitution, what exactly, what powers are given to the federal government, what powers are retained by the state governments. We obviously have conflicts within our country about what policies should be adopted by the government. But we work these out through the courts and through elections rather than by having wars. That's what Nigeria is doing right now as we speak, going from not having a reliable government to having a reliable government that takes care of eliminating conflict within the country, eliminating violence within the country. The court cases and the elections are actually substitutes for military battles in a war. In fact, we have to think about that, I think, when we have the kinds of conflict we have in our political institutions at the moment, to realize, what's the alternative? You want to have actual violent wars? Or do you want to fight it out at the ballot box? How much do our state governments spend on getting ready to fight wars with other states, compared with how much our federal government, our national government, pays to get ready for wars against other countries? Our states spend nothing on getting ready to fight each other, and they don't spy on each other. They're working together because they're a federation. Another important difference between confederations and federations is that within a federation, federal laws can be enforced against individual violators, while in a confederation, like the United Nations is, the efforts to enforce the rules is aimed at the constituent governments rather than individual persons, a system that is likely to produce wars, like the Korean War and like the First Gulf War, which were carried out by the United Nations, but they were still wars because that's how you have to settle disputes in a confederation. The recently developed International Criminal Court, which is designed to prosecute individual war criminals, is a giant step in the right direction on the international level. But it's not making much headway, partly because the United States is not a big supporter of the International Criminal Court, although President Obama is. But there are many leaders, both in government and out of government, that are not enthusiastic about the International Criminal Court. They don't want Americans being subject to the jurisdiction of the rest of the world. The gradual but difficult transition from a confederation to a federation is now taking place in the European Union, whose very name indicates the goal of federation. And they are moving toward federation, but they're not there yet. The situation in Europe shows how nationalism and feelings of national identity are powerful obstacles to the integration into a true federation. Success for them requires developing a feeling of European identity, which they're striving to do, but which their separate languages makes very difficult to do. A more important matter for the whole world and the abolition of war from human society is whether the Confederal United Nations can somehow be transformed into a world federation. An important book focused on this issue is The Anatomy of Peace by Emery Revis, first published in 1945 at the end of World War II and the beginning of the United Nations, 70 years ago. He says, and this is a quote, "If we attempt to reduce the seemingly innumerable causes of war to a common denominator, two clear and unmistakable observations emerge. Wars between groups of social units always take place when these units, whether tribes, dynasties, churches, cities, nation states, exercise unrestricted sovereign power. Then you have wars. Wars between these social units cease the moment sovereign power is transferred from them to a larger or higher unit, as happens in a federation." A new book making the same point, but with more attention to current developments, is Joseph Schwartzberg's book, Transforming the United Nations System, Designs for a Workable World, published by the UN University Press in 2013. Near the end of his incredibly detailed study, you read that book and you find out more about the United Nations than you will in any other way. He writes, quote, "I firmly believe that a democratic federal world government with a built-in constitutional system of checks and balances provides the best of the many conceivable future ways of governing our increasingly interconnected world. Given the existential environmental threats confronting our society, as well as the long-recognized threats from our presently anarchic war system, we must now plan for and seek to create an essentially new global political order as quickly as possible." We've got to figure out how do we move from the United Nations to something better. Experience has shown us that an effective way of ending wars between sovereign social units is to bring them together into a federation where conflicts of interest can be resolved nonviolently by judicial and political means, and where the rule of law is enforceable on individuals, not trying to do things to national governments. At the global level, so far we have managed to establish the confederation called the United Nations, and almost all of the countries of the world are in it. The difficult next step to creating a world with no more war is to transform that United Nations Confederation into a world federation. As in Europe, nationalism and feelings of national identity are powerful obstacles. Success requires promoting a feeling of world citizenship. At the world level, a big obstacle not faced by the European Union is the existence of non-democratic national governments in the United Nations. The transition from a confederation to a federation that I've been talking about has always involved democratic governments. An important question is whether that transition from a confederal UN to a democratic world federation can be made when so many of the constituent governments in the United Nations are not yet Western-style democracies. Perhaps NATO, where all members are democratic governments, might be a better base for creating a world federation than the United Nations. The difficulty, however, is that NATO does not include a lot of national governments. A lot of national governments are not in NATO, but the UN does include almost all national governments, which seems like maybe that's a better way of starting. In fact, we have to ask, would trying to create a world federation from NATO just lead to another war that all the countries that aren't in NATO might unite against NATO? So it's a problem. How do we move forward? It is too optimistic to suppose that a transition from the United Nations or from NATO to a democratic world federation will happen very soon, unfortunately. At the same time, the need to make this transition right now is very great. New technology is already producing robotic soldiers and ever more deadly weaponry and new kinds of cyber warfare and new types of biological chemical weapons, which can be produced secretly and inexpensively. Even small, poorer countries are going to be able to get involved in the struggle for power based on coercive military strength. You've attacked us and we'll deter you, we'll give you a plague or something like that. Somehow, we must persuade our leaders and our media to pay more attention to our war and militarism problem and devote themselves to developing a democratic world federation which will produce a world with no more war. An important first step is for each of us to move beyond our own nationalistic attitudes and focus on building not only our own land, but our whole world. So let us join now in singing hymn 121, but always changing that word land, which you have in the hymnal, to the word world, which Ken has done for us. Thus, let's now sing together, "We'll Build a World."
Thank you.
final statement comes from Edward Everett Hale. I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do the something that I can do. Go now in peace.